This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. This story is from our episode about biodiversity. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to quantify the variety of life on Earth and understand which species are disappearing, a big part of the work is to document what's here. One way that's done is by creating collections of specimens that are stored in natural history museums. I remember being blown away when the director of the National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. told me that they had 35,000 squirrels alone. 35,000! But this practice of collecting and cataloging has slowed down in recent decades. Alan Yu looks at why and what it means for science.
Maybe you guys have been behind the scenes before.
I'm in the basement of the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, the oldest natural history museum in the U.S. Curator and paleontologist Ted Deschler is showing me around.
We're in the oldest part of the academy. We're in the 1876 building.
It's dark and it smells like mothballs. I'm surrounded by tall shelves with drawers.
I'm going to open up this case here.
Ted shows me a neatly organized collection of mice from New Jersey and Pennsylvania. The mothballs are everywhere to keep insects out. The mouse skins are stuffed with cotton, and each specimen has its own label that shows when it was collected.
I'm looking at 1934 here. I recognize these older labels from Samuel Rhodes. This is 1897. These are more than a century old, and they're perfectly good shape.
There are mice from different places in the region and across time. Ted says these are important raw materials for research.
Until we have like a time machine, we're not going to be able to go back and know what the conditions were like in 1937 in Chester County, Pennsylvania.
Most of the specimens here are rodents, like mice and rats and rabbits and raccoons, because those animals are small, abundant, and easy to collect. Scientists now and in the future can use these specimens to answer questions about the animals themselves. How have they adapted or evolved over time? Scientists can also take hair, skin, DNA samples from the specimens to answer questions about the environment that would be very hard to answer otherwise. For example, there's a collection of rabbits from Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, part of a project studying the ecosystem around a nuclear power plant in the 1980s. And future scientists may have new questions and new tools to evaluate these samples. But the Academy itself no longer sends scientists out to collect new specimens of mammals.
So in this case, we haven't had active research since, like, World War II, believe it or not.
The museum used to add hundreds of new mammal specimens to its collection each decade. That slowed down to the double and later single digits in the 1990s. This is a trend across natural history collections in the U.S. overall. The number of mammal specimens collected each year has gone down by more than 50% since around the 1980s. A report from the National Academy of Sciences 2 years ago compared these collections to infrastructure, like air traffic control or the server rooms behind websites. They require active maintenance. Most people do not care about them when everything is going well, but find out very quickly when things go wrong. The decrease in new specimens is bad news for scientists whose work relies on these collections, like Stephanie Smith, a postdoctoral research scientist at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. She studies the spine architecture of mammals. Talking to Stephanie made me think of these natural history collections like a series of ice cores that show how the environment around these animals have changed over time.
For example, we have skeletons of mammals that go back until the early 1900s. And so if people stop collecting because they say, oh, this museum has hundreds and hundreds of this particular type of animal, then we lose that continuity.
Having fewer or missing specimens from the past few decades would be like having a big chunk of missing data about a time when the climate is changing quickly and animals are going extinct. It's like missing a few crucial pages from a diary. But Stephanie said these specimens are important for other kinds of research too, like discovering new species in a museum cabinet.
When someone opens a new drawer and finds, we thought these were all one species of, you know, sea star, and it turns out there's seven.
Just last December, some researchers looked at an old collection of shrews, small mole-like creatures from Indonesia, to realize they had found 14 new species of shrews. Because these are whole specimens, scientists can also take samples to study animal diseases and parasites from the past, some of which can make their way to humans. So if this work is so important, why is there less of it? The first issue is funding. Someone has to pay for all those mothballs, the space, and work to maintain existing collections, not to mention collecting new samples. The National Academy report describes this work as undervalued and underfunded, often threatened with budget cuts or in some cases being scrapped altogether. For example, more than 100 collections of preserved plant specimens in the US have closed since the late 1990s. There is another issue that is not as new but still comes up a lot, the toll these collections have on nature.
And a lot of times children will be like, do you kill the animals? And the answer is yes.
The idea often bothers kids who visit museums, but it's a topic of conversation among scientists as well, whether getting a specimen really requires killing an animal. Stephanie and the other researchers I spoke to emphasized that there is a very strict permitting process, and scientists have to be very specific and deliberate about collecting only as many as are necessary and doing so humanely. They will not kill any endangered animals, for example. But yes, they do kill the animals. That's because there is so much data that researchers cannot capture any other way. There's no other way to, say, study the internal organs of an animal or to get an x-ray of its skeleton. Kevin Winker, curator of birds at the University of Alaska Museum of the North in Fairbanks, put it this way.
I was actually releasing most of the data every time I let a bird go with a band on its leg.
The bird flies away and so does a lot of information. But killing an animal to add it to a collection is still a hard thing to do for scientists who study animals.
When I actively collect a bird, I feel like a little bit of my karma just got chipped away. These are wonderful animals. I justify it mentally by recognizing that when I do take a bird, I am putting it into a position to contribute for a very long time to what I understand and know to be high quality science. They are good for literally centuries.
Stephanie says when she talks to children at the museum, she describes the specimens as ambassadors.
Everything that we have in the museum is representing its species so that it can be better known and better understood and better protected.
Stephanie and Kevin and Ted and other researchers who rely on and maintain these collections say there are some solutions. Museums are working together to fill in gaps in knowledge and put their specimens online. That can be useful if one collection is missing data about a particular time. There are databases that did not exist before, like crowdsourced audio archives of birdsong. And Congress actually approved funding for a network of over 80 field sites to collect data about animals as well as their environments across the U.S. That started operating in the summer of 2019. Kevin Winker says ultimately, collecting this information will benefit both animals and humans.
And if we can understand the changes that we're causing to our co-occupants, we will be better managers of our own environments.